The Year in Review, what mattered most to you? It's time for our regular Month in Review program, but since this is the last day of not just the month, but also the year, we are going to look back at 2018 in Maine. Recent headlines have focused on politics, especially the historic November election, in which voters chose Maine's first woman governor and determined a congressional candidate using the new ranked choice voting system. But other important stories emerged this year as well. The deaths of two children in state custody, the shooting death of Somerset County Deputy Sheriff Eugene Cole, the continuing opioid epidemic, and Senator Collins' decision to vote for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh for the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Two Maine editorial page editors and our own Susan Sharon join us for analysis and perspective. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Where to begin? As 2018 comes to a close, today we look back on some of the stories that made headlines during the past 12 months. There was, of course, the election and sweeping changes coming to the State House, the role of ranked choice voting in the 2nd Congressional District race, Senator Collins facing tremendous pressure over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, continued issues with the state's Department of Child Welfare, the murder of Somerset County Sheriff Corporal Eugene Cole, some of the stories that made headlines this year that still matter to people in Maine. Joining me to look back on the year, Susan Sharon, Deputy News Director here at Maine Public Radio. Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal Morning Sentinel. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, who is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Thank you all for being here on this New Year's Eve. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think were the top stories and what mattered to you? Which stories are you still thinking about, talking about, do you think will have a lasting impact in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Ben, you're up first. It's been a tumultuous year. I think all of us, as we've been looking back at the year, can't even believe everything that has happened in the last 12 months. As you step back and try to put it in perspective, what are you thinking about right now?
Well, the new year is all about, you know, wiping the slate clean and starting all over again. And, you know, nowhere is that happening more than at the State House. Like you just mentioned, there were sweeping changes at the election. The Democrats have the governor's office, and they have the Senate, and they have a larger lead in the House than they did last year. And that brings with it a lot of opportunities and a lot of potential. And since the election, that's what we've been talking about, the potential. What are they going to do? What are they going to do with this opportunity now that, you know, after 8 years of having Governor LePage kind of set the agenda, the Democrats are going to have it again. Janet Mills is going to have that opportunity. She gets inaugurated on Wednesday. And then all that potential will have to, you know, turn into real work. And that's kind of going to lay out the landscape for politics in 2019. Maine has these huge structural problems with jobs and workforce and population and healthcare, energy, all these things that we didn't make a lot of progress, in my opinion, in the last few years, largely because of all these problems at the State House between LePage and his allies and the Democrats and often the Republicans, too. And it was just kind of this mess for at least 2 years and probably more. With this new legislature coming in, we can at least have some hope that that will clear up and that everybody will work together to try and get things done. That doesn't sound like it can last very long. It didn't last very long 8 years ago when the Republicans were in the same situation. But New Year's all about hope, so we can hope that you know, the 2019 will be a year where we see the state government work again.
That's right, Ben, because 8 years ago, and tell me if my memory's failing me, Governor LePage was elected, but also the state Senate went Republican for the first time in a lot of years, but only lasted, you said, two years.
Yeah, I mean, LePage came in and wanted to get a lot done quickly, and he doesn't have a lot of patience for the legislative process, and he didn't then. And the Republicans who were in the legislature were trying to concentrate on doing things in a way that would help them in 2 years when they knew they had to run again. And that led to some friction. 2 years later, the Democrats got back the House, I believe. And then since then, it's been split government. And there hasn't been a whole lot of movement either way.
Okay, back to 2018, Susan. As you think, Susan Sharon, as you look back at this year, are there any themes you see emerging?
The Me Too movement, I think, is a huge theme. And you know, I'm still seeing it in when you look in social media and you look at, you know, your Facebook as the inauguration of Janet Mills takes place in Maine this week, as Ben mentioned. I'm struck as I look back the year, as you said, it was just a year of political tumult and change and a lot of mayhem and, you know, a lot of tragedies, deaths. It's hard to find a really good news story, but except for this Me Too movement and some of the things that happened there, you know, on the streets, when women were out on the streets around the Kavanaugh vote and going to Senator Susan Collins' office and sitting in, it became sort of like a almost like a revival meeting of women on the street just deciding on the spur of the moment to share their story of sex harassment, sex abuse, and some very poignant moments, very in a very supportive crowd. So I'm thinking about that and thinking about them and thinking about what happens next with that movement. What does it mean for Janet Mills to become the first woman governor, the woman of a lot of firsts, the first woman prosecutor in Maine, the first woman attorney general, and now the first woman governor, even after, you know, she'd run before for Congress and not made it, and what she can say to girls and young women about that and what it means for other women coming up through the ranks, you know, especially in a year when more women were elected to the legislature than ever before.
All right, Susan Young, what are you thinking about today?
I'm thinking about how exhausted we all are from everything that's happened in the political world this year. I mean, we started the year trying to figure out what Congress had done by voting for tax cuts, eliminating the individual mandate under the ACA. What did that mean for the future of that program? We had a legislative session that went into September, which was unprecedented. We had crowded primaries for governor from both the Republican and Democratic fields, and pretty mellow gubernatorial campaign, but kind of nasty congressional campaign in the second district, which just ended last week when Bruce Poliquin dropped his legal challenges to ranked choice voting. It's just been a year of unexpected twists and turns, and it seemed like we could never catch our breath. You mentioned the Kavanaugh hearings with Senator Collins, and we never knew what was coming out of the White House and who was leaving the White House. And then we find out today that Elizabeth Warren has launched an exploratory committee for 2020. So, you know, here we go with the next round of political races. It's just exhausting.
and it probably will take some time to have some true perspective, but I am asking you all here today, and I appreciate you doing your best here on this final day of this exhausting year. Susan Sharon, what about a smaller story that fascinated you? Is there anything that, you know, we haven't maybe mentioned in this big list of headline-grabbing news that kind of sticks out?
Well, I know you all have talked about this earlier in the year, but to me, one of the interesting things that happened in Maine, and it has been talked about, but not in a while, is the Jackman town manager getting outed, you know, by a couple of reporters on a Friday afternoon, I think, and through social media, and then by Tuesday was out of a job. I mean, you just don't. And this, by the way, for his, you know, white separatist views, he wanted to create a white separate community in Western Maine. But, you know, we always hear of Maine being the whitest state, and Jackman is just an outpost in, you know, the 2nd Congressional District. It's on the Canadian border. It's pretty isolated. And so for for so much reaction to come so fast, just from the entire state, but then for the people of Jackman to take that action and terminate his contract within just a few days was pretty amazing to me. And I thought it probably should have had more play, really, frankly, in the country.
What about you, Ben?
Well, this story, too, kind of came and went, but it was part of a much larger story. But the mystery ballots in Booth Bay Harbor from the Poliquin Golden Race, I think, is just an odd story that never really got any resolution, and it probably won't. But
refresh
sure,
us.
Sure. A few weeks into the controversy over the second district congressional race. There are some voters in the Booth Bay region, which is in the first congressional district, signed affidavits saying that they believed that when they went in to vote in the first congressional district, that they had ballots for the second congressional district. The Secretary of State's office told us that is impossible. Because the ballots would never get there, and if they did, they wouldn't be able to be counted by the machine, so the machine would kick them back. It would be obvious if there were that so many people. But all these folks, all Republicans, all Bruce Poliquin supporters, said that they thought that they probably saw one. I mean, when they were pressed on it, it seemed like they were kind of fuzzy on it, but they all kind of got together and had this kind of group delusion that they saw these ballots when they didn't. And it was kind of thrown into the whole story as another example from the Republicans of why ranked choice voting was chaotic and compromised in all these ways, even though it would have had no effect on the final tally. But it's just really strange that this many people could think that they had the wrong ballot. And apparently people just started talking a few days later, and one said, I think I had the Poliquin ballot. Another one said, I think I did too. And it kind of took off from there. And it's just a very strange, inconsequential story, but just a really weird one.
Susan Young, what about you? A small story that you keep thinking about.
Governor LePage's health. I mean, we found out weeks after it happened that apparently he had fallen off a bicycle in Florida and I believe had surgery on his shoulder. And then in the fall, he had, quote, discomfort in New Brunswick and ended up in the hospital in Bangor for what I think we later learned were chest pains. And it's just so odd that we knew so little about it, perhaps in the discomfort incident, his power was passed over to the president of the Senate, who is next in line, which would indicate that it's pretty serious. But it was just emblematic of the lack of transparency coming from the LePage administration, but also just so much we don't know. And I think that's true about LePage in general. We ended up electing a governor that we're not even sure what his full resume is, who he worked for, what he did. It's just very odd to me that we've had a governor for 8 years that we know so little about. And that was one example of a situation where we were just left to guess and wonder what actually happened. And, fortunately, he's okay, it appears, but it could have been a bad situation that it seemed like the state wasn't prepared for.
We're talking about the year in review in news in Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. I want to bring up a few specific stories. If we were doing a month in review program as opposed to a year in review, we'd definitely be talking about this. On Christmas Eve, Bruce Poliquin announced he is dropping the appeal through federal court of the ranked choice voting and bringing an end, really, to the election. And Susan Young, I'm going to toss this back to you. My understanding was that this really wasn't just about the second congressional district race in Maine, but that the National Republican Party wanted to take this case through the courts to test ranked choice voting because it believes other states will adopt ranked choice voting. Was that not the case? Or if it was the case, why did the larger party decide to drop these appeals?
Well, unfortunately, we don't actually know why, so we're kind of left to speculate. But you're right, the National Republican Party and other groups paid for the attorneys who represented Bruce Poliquin and the three other plaintiffs in the lawsuit, just as Democratic interest paid for the case on the other side, because they have an interest in defending ranked choice voting, proving that it's constitutional, and encouraging other states to use it as well. So, you know, in a sense, it was a proxy fight by national interest. But you have to believe there was some sort of internal struggle or deliberation, if you will. And perhaps, you know, Bruce Poliquin saw where this was headed and realized that, you know, he'd had enough. If he wants to run again in 2020, at this point, he's certainly the front runner to challenge Jared Golden in 2 years. But, you know, how far can he go with a lawsuit with the statements that his campaign was putting out that barely made sense, continued to talk about black boxes and artificial intelligence when this wasn't really a complicated system? And federal judge and a panel at the First Circuit Court of Appeals made it very clear that ranked choice voting is constitutional. It doesn't violate people's rights. So clearly the legal argument was not going well. Supreme Court, with its current makeup, anybody's guess what would have happened there. And that's why there was so much speculation that that's where they finally wanted to get the case. But, you know, unless we talk to the parties themselves, were left to guess about their motives and why they dropped the case.
Sure, Ben. And I think just last month we were talking about this good chance of this headed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and at least not Maine's case.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't look good for Poliquin's side of things. The Judge Walker's decision was very exact and very thorough. The three appeals judges told him he wasn't likely to win on the merits. So it didn't look good going forward. And maybe there's some consideration for 2020, and maybe there's some, not wanting to have ranked choice voting declared constitutional by the Supreme Court and take that away from this argument that they're going to have again in 2 years over ranked choice voting. So there was a little bit of that, and obviously coming on Christmas Eve, that's what you do when you want to hide news. So timing was definitely, I think, taken into account.
Oh my goodness, we've barely scratched the surface and it's already time for a break. So if you'd like to join our conversation about Maine news in 2018, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. The email address, brief email please, brieftalk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com. And New England Cancer Specialists, committed to leading the way to better outcomes for 50 years. More at newenglandcancerspecialists.org.
Both Maine Public Radio and Television will carry the upcoming inauguration ceremony for Maine's 75th and first female governor-elect, Janet Mills. The event takes place at the Augusta Civic Center and gets underway at 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 2nd. The ceremony consists of a joint legislative session, the swearing-in ceremony, and the governor's inaugural address. Join Maine Public Radio, Television, and online services for special live coverage of the inauguration ceremony of Governor Janet Mills, Wednesday evening, January 2nd, starting at 6.
From Tokyo to New York City, with stops along the way, we're ringing in 2019 on Toast of the Nation. Featuring artists like Dee Dee Bridgewater, the Ron Carter Quartet, and the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, and more. Our annual holiday tradition continues with great music to celebrate the new year. I'm your host, Christian McBride. Don't miss the party on Toast of the Nation from WBGO and NPR Music.
This New Year's Eve special starts at 8 this evening and goes all the way to 2 a.m. on New Year's Day here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Year in Review. Yes, it is New Year's Eve. Joining me, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor of the Kennebec How come I can't say Kennebec today? Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Collins, Susan Young, the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, and Susan Sharon, deputy news director here at Maine Public Radio. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before we get to the calls, though, I want to bring up at least one really big story this year and really sad story, Susan Sharon, and that's back in April, the shooting death of a Somerset County Deputy Corporal Eugene Cole. And I'm thinking about that story, and I think for all of Maine, it was such a shock, because I think we think things like that don't happen here. But I'm looking at a story in the Boston Herald from yesterday talking about how across the country, more and more police officers were killed this past year than the year before. A lot more, sort of 144 to, I don't have the number right here, but from 100, a large increase. And is what happened here in Maine part of a larger trend or not? Is it just a really rotten story?
Well, I think it's a really rotten story no matter what. The fact that he was the first law enforcement officer in Maine killed in the line of duty in nearly three decades doesn't suggest that it's a trend at this point. Hopefully not. And the circumstances of it are still, maybe Ben can explain a little bit more, but the circumstances are still a little, we don't know yet. The man who is charged with that.
John Williams.
John Williams. He'll be coming up in court in the next few months. But what we do know is that, that for some reason, Corporal Cole, while on patrol, stopped Williams, I believe, and they had some kind of an encounter, which we don't know exactly what happened, but it appears that Cole was trying to arrest Williams, and he was killed in the process. And then there was this ensuing manhunt for several days involving hundreds of police, law enforcement, sheriff's deputies, the FBI. And we'll see what happens. The other tragic part of it is on the side of Williams. Apparently, he had a history of he had interacted with the law in Massachusetts and was facing drug charges. There were stories that came out during his arrest of him being in withdrawal, and how that may have played into this is also a factor.
Ben, anything to add?
Well, it's just, Corporal Cole was, he wasn't serving a warrant. He wasn't busting down a door. He was driving around, seeing what was going on in his community. And I'm sure he stopped a million times for broken down cars and hit animals and someone walking down the road and, all these things that came together to put Corporal Cole and John Williams, allegedly John Williams, on this driveway in the middle of the night and have it end this way. It's just such a shock, and it really shows the danger that officers live with, whether they're in New York or Boston or Norridgewock, that they have to treat, everything around. Sometimes, people can be critical of police officers because of how they act, and there's certainly been a lot of that, and some of it warranted, but they don't know what's around the corner. And in this case, it was something very dangerous. And, we'll hear more when the trial starts. I think the trial's coming up this summer. As Susan mentioned, there is a hearing coming up in February. Williams's attorney wants anything he said to the cops thrown out because of the opioid withdrawal and because what he says is violence from the officers. We saw when he was caught, the state police photo, or someone took a photo of him with his head pulled back by the hair. It was the photo they used to send to the other officers to verify that they had caught him. But somebody leaked that to the press, and there was a lot about that for a few days.
I think social media.
Yeah,
Instagram.
Social media,
it was
right?
Instagram, I believe.
And it went around, and it did not look good. A lot of people saying, well, it's whatever happened there. Taking out some frustration over what happened and that sort of thing, but it could actually have some legal ramifications. But yeah, just a shocking and sad story about, you know, the danger that police officers have, about the what happens to somebody when they get hooked on opioids and just lose complete control of their life. I mean, John Williams at one point, you know, when he was 16, 17, wasn't thinking he was going to become a police killer. And if they hadn't come together that night, maybe he never would have. It's really senseless, and it's hard not to. We always want to try to put these things in categories. Oh, this is part of the opioids or part of violence against police officers, and sometimes it's just something we can't wrap our head around.
And Susan Young, the other really, really, really heartbreaking story this year, the deaths of two children in a state custody. I know the Bangor Daily News has been doing a lot of coverage, as all the media outlets in Maine, about the state's child welfare system, potential reforms to DHHS. Do you believe there will be lasting changes after these deaths?
I sure hope so. And as we've seen with these kind of horrific situations in the past, it captures everyone's attention, and there are calls and a groundswell for change. The question is what those changes will be, and do they go too far in an opposite direction, which is kind of hard to imagine given the, you know, horrific tragedy. But there were proposals from the governor to lean less on kinship placements, which is what the department has been prioritizing when children do need to be removed from their parents, to keep them with the family. And the thought was that these two children were with relatives, and sadly, it didn't end well, so maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. The danger is if you go too far in the other direction, our already stressed foster care system is going to have so many more children that they will have a hard time placing them, and that's not in the children's best interest. So the question, I think, is what kind of reforms, and we just need to be careful not to move too far in the wrong direction. Another proposal from the governor was to, I think, throw people in jail if they were mandated reporters and they didn't report. Well, we know from the situation with Marissa Kennedy that the Bangor school system did report their suspicions of abuse, but they never heard from the department, so they don't know if their reports were investigated, did folks at DHHS need more information. They just never heard. So it doesn't seem like it's a problem of mandated reporters not doing what they're legally required to do. It's a problem of the department not having the staff, and the staff not having the training and resources to do the follow-up that needs to be done to try to ensure that these situations don't happen again.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, everyone, panel. I wanted to go back to an event already mentioned, but rather extraordinary for Maine, and that was the entire country tuning in to see our Senator, Susan Collins, address the Kavanaugh hearing. It's probably the most national interest in something a Mainer has done since Joshua Chamberlain and Civil War. I don't know. What was remarkable about the speech, too, was it wasn't on one hand, on the other hand. She decided that the Me Too people were wrong, and folks who were concerned about the environment were wrong, and proceeded to tell them they were wrong over and over again for 40 minutes. I thought it was an amazing speech to be given by a politician who generally would seek to please everyone. That didn't occur in that case.
John, thank you for your insight. Ben.
Yeah, John, I think you're absolutely right. I was very surprised when she came out with that speech. She, Susan Collins, as kind of a history of being a centrist. People say moderate a lot, but she kind of stays in the middle, wherever that middle is. And she was kind of seemed like she was kind of staking out this ground just in the inside of the Trump thing, but also away from the Democrats. And she's kind of as a keeper of the light of the Senate and all these other things. And she kind of threw that away, I thought, when she gave that speech. I think it was probably indicative of what she was feeling personally. I think that you saw what I think that is legitimately how she feels, but also what she thinks of her party and her place in the party going forward. That was a 2020 primary speech, if I've ever seen one, speaking directly to the Republican base that she has to please to not get a primary challenge, not to the general electorate that's going to have to elect her and may not be quite as open to electing her in 2 years as they have been in the past.
Susan Sharon.
Yeah, I mean, she's coming under a lot of criticism now for saying that the women in the Me Too movement should be believed, but that sexual assault victims deserve to be heard, but not this woman and her. I felt like the speech was a legal argument that had been prepared quite, you know, that her people had spent a lot of time helping her with, prepare this legal argument on how to manage the vote for Kavanaugh. And, you know, the basis of her argument was that she didn't think that the allegations of sexual misconduct had been corroborated against him, and proceeded to go from there. So now she's under scrutiny for that. Although I think, you know, some people say she's really not as moderate as has been the description of her, you know, and there's been looks at her record of voting for Trump 79% of the time or something like that. So it will be interesting to see. You know, the money is already being raised by opponents are already, and her critics are already raising a campaign fund to put out other people, and people are making feelers about challenging her again, but we don't know if she will run again.
Susan Young, as you reflect on the Kavanaugh hearings and Senator Collins' role in them, do you believe that her decision was affected by what she talks about, the scathing attacks on her personally?
I think those did affect her. And I think she was also affected by the attacks, the consequences for Judge Kavanaugh. Not unexpectedly, people's reaction to her speech is colored by their political beliefs and background. And we certainly heard from a lot of conservatives about what a wonderful speech it is. Some people even called it her declaration of conscience speech, you know, in a serious way, and were giving her great credit for it because they saw her as standing up against unwarranted attacks on an innocent man, and went so far as to say that, you know, if he can be dragged through the mud, so can all of us, because, you know, people can accuse us of anything without proof, which is, I think, a very extreme position. But it was persuasive to a lot of folks, and that's certainly the message that the right was bringing out of the Kavanaugh hearings, that, you know, if his nomination went down, it was going to be anarchy because women and others could make any kind of charges and ruin someone's career. They even went so far as to say ruin his life, although he'd still be on the federal bench getting a nice paycheck and a nice pension. So it's hard to see how his life was in any way ruined like that of a victim of sexual assault. So, you know, it was very fraught discussion that we had. And unfortunately, I don't think there's a lot of common ground between those two sides. And going forward, people are going to take very different messages out of her speech and ultimately how the vote turned out.
We'll go to Maura calling from Falmouth. Hi, Maura. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. So one of my concerns that came up this year was the asylum seekers and the fact that the rules have been changed, whether we like it or not, and how that affects our workforce in Maine. We've always relied on migrant farm workers, and right now I have friends who have businesses, and they're just not able to get employees. So one thing, it's just inhumane, the conditions the children and others are being kept in. And the other is, do we really want someone changing the rules like this? That's my comment.
It's a really good issue that you brought up, and I'm glad that you did. Especially regarding asylum seekers, it's really troubling that I don't know that we've actually changed the rules on paper. We're just acting very differently at the border. But there's also international laws about how you treat asylum seekers and refugees. And the United States right now is violating those laws with impunity. There's no consequences. No one is coming after the country to say, hey, you know, you can do what you want with your own laws, but there are international standards. And, you know, hopefully that will get a lot more attention going forward and some changes will be made. But I also want to stress that people that come here to work as migrant labor are not asylum seekers. Generally, asylum seekers are people coming to the U.S. to escape persecution and other horrible trauma in their home countries. And that's why they have a right to come to the border and request asylum and have their requests go through an official process. They are not supposed to just be turned around. And despite what the president says, they do need to come to the U.S. to make their case. They can't make their case from Honduras or Syria. They need to actually be here. So it's an issue that deserves a lot more attention and a lot more honesty going forward.
Maura, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about the year in review. We'll be right back.
Have you subscribed to The 10 yet? The 10 is Maine Public's free weekly emailed newsletter, our curated look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories. Not necessarily from the front page, that you might have missed during the week, chosen from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, American Public Media, PRX, the BBC, and more. We are now putting together a special end-of-the-year edition that highlights the 10 best Maine Public news stories. To sign up, go to mainepublic.org. Enjoy!
Did you know if you are 70 and a half years or older, you can make a tax-free gift directly to Maine Public from your individual retirement account? Giving from your IRA is a smart way to enjoy tax savings and support Maine Public. Hi, I'm Scott Marshallton, Chief Development Officer at Maine Public. When you give through your IRA, your donation will count towards your required minimum distribution for the current year, and you can exclude up to $100,000 of this gift from your federal gross income, resulting in lower taxable income and possible tax savings. You can do this anytime, but your gift must be completed by December 31st in order to receive the maximum benefits for the current tax year. For more information, go online at mainepublic.org and click on support. Again, that's mainepublic.org and click on support. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a look back at the headlines of 2018 here in Maine. My guests are Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Susan Sharon, deputy news director here at Maine Public Radio, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal Morning Sentinel. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. What mattered most to you? We're going to go to Susan, who's calling from Abbott. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi there. The opioid crisis was a big story this last year, but one aspect of it that I never heard addressed was the fact that almost every baby in the U.S. gets their first opioid hit when the mother's in labor, and that's via the epidural. The epidural is just a space. It's not a drug, but the drugs that are put in the epidural are opioids. And one of the most common ones is bupivacaine. And we go to the FDA website, you discover that it does indeed cross the placenta.
Okay, Susan, thanks for your call. I want to sort of go where Susan started in talking about the opioid crisis. And I want to mention also that coming up in the month of January, Maine Calling will be doing a program talking about babies and the great number of babies who are born addicted to opioids and other substances. But, you know, Ben, this crisis is not abating. The opioid crisis is not abating. The numbers are still about a person a day dying, aren't they, in this
yeah.
state?
Yeah, I mean, we were very slow to catch on to it. This was really, I mean, to kind of look at a broader thing, I think this was very quietly going on in Maine for a while. You remember we had that spate of drugstore robberies that was really bad. I think it was like 2011, 2010, maybe a little before then. And it was really had like gotten its grips in, I think, before we really started to see it. and people went from diverted pills to heroin. And then when fentanyl came to Maine, a very strong, addictive opioid, that's really what has kept these deaths up, is that it's such a deadly disease. And we haven't really responded in the way to the size of the problem. There was some little things done here, and the legislature finally last year passed the first big collection of bills to address this, and we were years into it, and we were, so the treatment infrastructure was underfunded. No one really knew how to handle it, so we the police did some things and hospitals did some things and treatment providers did other things, and we never had this big cohesive movement to initiative to go after it. I think there's, we're gonna see some movement this year. All along, the Governor LePage was kind of in a bind, in that the biggest thing he could have done to address this crisis is to expand Medicaid to get the most amount of treatment to the most number of people, and he wasn't gonna do that because he doesn't believe in it. And absent that, there was really a bunch of small things that he could do, and he did do some of them, but none of them on the level that they needed. Janet Mills says she's going to expand Medicaid on her first day. That'll help. There's a lot of other things going on around the state that really need a top person to kind of coordinate everything. It's just kind of this patchwork of treatments, and some are good and some are bad and some are untested. And until we kind of pull that all together, this is going to stick around. I mean, some states have had some success doing those things, so we should see that kind of abate. But you saw that the most prescribed drug in Maine is Suboxone. I mean, it really shows the depth of this crisis that's going on, and that will it's not going to go away anytime soon. It's going to be something we're going to be dealing with for a long time.
Susan Charon, Janet Mills says she'll expand Medicaid. She also says that this is her number one priority, is the state's opioid epidemic. What can she do that's not already being done? What can one governor do?
Well, that is a huge question. I mean, and by the way, it's just not one person. It's been going on for probably close to two decades that we've really been covering this, and starting in Washington County until now. So, you know, it's been around, and multiple governors have had a shot at this, multiple legislatures. I would point out that, for example, you know, when we were just talking about the child welfare system and how to address that after the tragic deaths of two kids this year, the legislature, as Ben mentioned, opted to spend money on a package of bills, about $6 or $7 million. $6 or $7 million is the most that we've spent addressing this problem. And I think I always like to equate things with like the cost of a new middle school. And I believe the cost of a new middle school in Maine, the average cost is like $26 million. So it helps me with my perspective on how much that really is. And even with the child reforms, the child welfare system, it was something like $21 million. And the governor got involved in that particular case. So, you know, with his action, they passed money, and the legislature went along. But yet we still haven't seen, even though there have been task force after task force, and, you know, this idea that there should be multiple ways to address this problem with prevention, treatment, and law enforcement, it still, as Ben says, hasn't come together. And I don't know what the barriers are for that. You know, Janet Mills and others will say it's Medicaid expansion, and that can help with treatment. But I've started to think myself that prevention has to be more of a priority in this discussion, because really educating people, young people, about what fentanyl does and what happens to you, you know, once you start, and getting out of it as soon as possible and getting treatment as soon as possible, it's got to be every single thing. And I just don't think that we've brought the pressure to bear enough yet. We spent a lot of time, for example, talking about Narcan, and that's the end. That's the end way to deal with it, not the beginning.
Yeah, we did spend a lot of time arguing about Narcan when that should have just been a first day one. Okay, what do we have to do? We have to keep people alive. Let's keep people alive. And then you move on from there and you try to do other things, but we couldn't, and we couldn't because too many people still see people who have drug addictions as that's their problem. They've brought them on themselves. We treat that far different than we treat anything, even smoking or, you know, poor diet and poor exercise that lead to heart disease. We don't judge people the way we judge people who become addicted to drugs. That changes usually when you have someone in your family who goes through something like that and you see how addiction works. But we had a lot of people in the legislature who just didn't, you know, every year saw those overdose statistics and said, it's a shame, but people chose to go down that road and that's what they get.
And Susan Young, one thing I'm wondering is, even if we get the money, even if under this new administration, the state, much more money is allocated either through Medicaid expansion or direct funding or both, is there the expertise out there? Are the numbers out there to address the magnitude of this problem?
I mean, what we do know is that medication-assisted treatment is the most successful way to help people who are suffering from substance abuse disorder. You know, the numbers are still much lower than we'd like, but research shows that that is the one thing to do. So beyond Medicaid expansion, there are two easy things that Janet Mills and the legislature can do. They can raise the reimbursement rates for physicians that prescribe methadone and Suboxone. They can also get rid of the caps that hinder treatment, because we know that people don't need to be on these replacement drugs, which unfortunately that's what they are. They're not. You're taking a less harmful drug to deal with your addiction, but you're going to be on that for years. So putting a cap on those drugs is setting people up for failure, because we know they need them for the long term, not just a couple of years. So those are two very easy things that could be done quickly. Not going to solve the problem, but they would make a difference.
All right, we're going to go to Marty in Biddeford. Is this Marty Grohman?
Hi, Jennifer. Yes, it is.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say really quick, a great discussion. I'm going to be continuing to do those recovery workforce job fairs through this year, putting them together with Sheriff King and hopefully Sheriff Joyce as well. And if people want to stay up to date on that, just visit Independent Marty Grohman on Facebook. But I'm just excited about pairing people in recovery up with employment.
All right. Thanks for your call, Marty. And one of the sort of big, not a news story or a news headline, but one of the big unfolding stories, and you mentioned this at the very beginning, Ben, the employment problem. You know, we have this low unemployment rate, but not a really wealthy state, a very below national average as salaries.
Yeah, the Department of Labor, had a study come out that showed almost zero job growth for the next 10 years from 2016 to 2026, and that's really the kind of core of a lot of the state's issues economically, is that we just don't have enough people, and our unemployment rate keeps going down, and our participation rate keeps going up. And at this point, those aren't really great things. You know, we're kind of at full employment, and, you see people, the reason participation rate's going back is people going back into the workforce because they have to work or something. There's a lot of open jobs out there, and there's a lot of a potential for growth that isn't happening because we just don't have enough people. I mean, that hasn't always been the case, but it's the case now, and it's going to be if we don't reverse some of these trends. That's a huge problem, and it's turning around an Air Force carrier.
We have an email from Dre in Naples. Something that stands out for me is the distress and danger journalists must be feeling because of events this year, like Annapolis and Jamal Khashoggi. I can't stand the sniping and scorn and outright incitement and complicity I hear from purported leaders at the top. Sheesh, journalists, and what they actually do for democratic society needs to be supported and appreciated. Thank you, Dre, for that sentiment. And Susan Young, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, amen. I think we all kind of set it aside and go about our daily jobs. But certainly this has been a terrible year for journalists. Deaths are way up. Again, it doesn't help when you have a governor and a president who portray and call the journalists the enemy. I mean, we're not the enemy. We're doing the jobs that we do because we believe the public needs to know what's being done on their behalf with their money. You know, it sounds kind of Pollyanna, but you know, the founding fathers believed in journalism and protected us with the First Amendment because even though they sometimes really hated journalists and what they wrote about them, they understood the value of that watchdog role. And that's what we do on a daily basis. I mean, I don't think any of us really enjoy sitting through city council meetings and FOIAing documents, but we're doing it all on behalf of our readers and our listeners and our viewers to let them know what their government is doing, again, with their money. So, you know, I think it's a very important role, and it's unfortunate that it's de rigueur right now to attack us, to mock us, to threaten and sometimes actually be violent against us. So let's hope in 2019 that this fades away.
Well, with just a couple minutes left, I'm looking at my list of things we have not talked about yet. And one of them, we think we've had a really, really busy, tumultuous year. But how about Secretary of State Matt Dunlap? He's had a year.
Yeah.
Yes, he has.
Yeah, maybe the person of the year. I mean, if it wasn't for, you know, Janet Mills' win, you could really make an argument that Matt Dunlap is the main person of the year. You know, he's involved with the Voter Fraud Commission, with the recounts.
He sued the Voter Fraud Commission.
He's been on ranked choice voting, a number of issues that he seems to always be in the front of. Very delicate and contentious issues he handled very well with a lot of professionalism. And you know, he runs a good office, and they really were put to the test this year.
Oh, I thought you were going to jump in, Susan.
No, but I would agree. I mean, he has a great sense of humor, and but he's just like straight out of Central Casting. You know, he has the credibility and the good sense of humor and good sense of history. He's the whole package.
Yeah, I mean, we have to. When you go in and vote, you have to believe that your ballot's going to be protected and it's going to be counted. And we've seen over the last year that if people don't believe in that, then everything falls apart. And in 2 years, there's going to be a lot of pressure on our electoral system as all these things that we saw this year, the re-election campaign of President Trump, all these other things coming crashing together in the 2020 campaign. It's going to put a lot of stress on that. And, you know, we have to have things in this country that we all believe in. One of those is the electoral system. It takes people like Matt Dunlap to protect them and to give us the confidence that we need.
I know you guys are going to be really disappointed, but we've run out of time and I can't ask you for your predictions for the upcoming year.
Oh, good.
Thank you all for being here. The voice you just heard, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor of the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Young has joined us from our Bangor studio. She's the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. And here in the studio with us, Susan Sharon, deputy news director for Maine Public Radio. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and we had help from George Thomas in our Bangor studio. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.